So in this final session today, I'd like to begin with a meditation again. Sort of foundational Vipassana practice, focusing on the body. But this time I'd like to expand it a little bit. So far we've just been doing the body scan, mainly focusing on the transient nature of the body. In this meditation, we're not going to serially scan the body, we're just going to observe the body and whatever is arising in the body. And for the first third of the meditation, we'll be focusing on the first of the three marks of existence, impermanence. Noticing what arises, is it something that's constantly changing or is it more static? In the middle part of the meditation, we'll shift to the second of the three marks of existence. We'll be observing whatever arises in the body and seeing, is this in the nature of happiness or is it in the nature of dukkha? Is it unsatisfactory by nature? And then in the third part of meditation, we'll be looking at the third of the three marks of existence, self, no self. So whatever is arising in the body, is that the self or is it something that is being observed? So we'll be doing that. So we'll be doing splitting the meditation into those three parts, the three marks of existence, but all the time simply observing whatever's arising in the body, not serially scanning. Okay, so let's do that practice and then we'll go back into the text. We're settling the body into a state of relaxation, stillness, and vigilance. A vigilant posture is keeping the back nice and straight. And at the same time, allowing the entire body to become completely relaxed. Relaxing more deeply with each out-breath. And with each out-breath, letting go of any thoughts that may have arisen. And bringing the mind into the present moment. Focusing on the sensations of the breath throughout the body. and then we can begin the Vipassana meditation. And for the first part, we will focus on the first of the three marks of existence, impermanence. So simply noticing any sensations arising in the field of the body. Noticing, are they static or are they constantly changing? And then we can continue to observe the field of the body, but now move to the second of the three marks of existence, that is dukkha. So observing whatever sensations arising in the body and asking the question, is it by nature in the nature of happiness, or is it by nature dukkha, unsatisfactory? and now continuing to observe whatever is arising in the field of the body. Then asking the question, is this the self? Or is it simply an object that is being observed? So let's go back to the presentation of tenets text on the first page. We finished by looking at the definition of a person who propounds Buddhist tenets, was a person propounding tenets who asserts the three jewels to be the final objects of refuge and who does not accept any objects of refuge other than these. So we saw that this is in terms of conduct. We can also talk about being Buddhist in terms of philosophical view. So if we accept these four seals, we can be said to be a Buddhist in terms of our philosophical view. So here in the tenets text, then we have four divisions of proponents of Buddhist tenets. We have the four schools there, Vaibhashika, Sautrantika, Chittimatra, and Majjhimika. It says the first two of these are also called the two schools that propound truly existent external objects. So that's what we've already briefly seen, that these two schools we're looking at this weekend accept that there are truly existent external objects, that there is an objective world there, and we're not mistaken with respect to that. And then we now talk about the meaning of each division. So now we're going to look at the explanation of each of the four schools, Vaibhashika, Sautrantika, Chittimatra, and Majjhimika. And this weekend we're going to look at the Vaibhashika, Sautrantika school. So let's turn over the page and begin to look at the Vaibhashika school. Each of these presentations are divided into these same seven sections. First, the definition of someone who propounds those tenets. Divisions is the various sub-schools within that school. Etymology, the meaning of the name of the school. Way of asserting objects. So this is how the school asserts objects. And here in this particular section, we'll see a little bit about what's called the two truths. And then the fifth section, way of asserting object possessors. So an object possessor, another name is subject. So particularly in this section, we're going to see a lot about what is valid cognition and valid inference and so forth. And then, of course, in section six, the way of asserting selflessness. So as we saw, all of the schools accept selflessness and this grasping onto self as being the problem. So we'll see at how each of the schools has their own understanding of what it means to realize selflessness and also the idea of emptiness. And then based on that, how we progress on the path, and that's the seventh presentation of the grounds and paths, is how on the basis of realizing this selflessness, we traverse the spiritual path to the goal of nirvana or enlightenment. So we'll have those same seven outlines for each of the four schools. So first, the Vaibhashika, the definition. So the proponent of Vaibhashika is a person propounding Hinayana tenets. So here it means tenets where the goal is nirvana, overcoming samsara, who does not accept self-cognition but does accept truly existent external objects. So maybe just to, even though they don't accept self-cognition, maybe just to talk a little bit about this self-cognition. Self-cognition, and to do this, I'll read from this book here, Buddhist Philosophy, and he talks about this idea of self-cognition on page 70. And the section here is, does the mind know itself? And he says here, the two Western scholars who've translated this root text from Jungyam Shapa, and then there's also a short commentary, but they also add their own comments as well. Daniel Kozort and Craig Preston are the authors of this book. So this is their words, what they're saying. He says, those who follow Dharmakirti, that is, we saw that some of the Sautrantikas follow Dharmakirti, contend that our subjective consciousness is also an object of consciousness, That is, the mind itself is itself known at the same time it knows its object. Otherwise, they argue, we could not remember not only the things we experience, but our experiencing itself. That we can remember our own seeing, hearing, etc., is broadly accepted. Those who say self-consciousness exists say that mind is like a lamp. At the same time it illuminates other things, it illuminates itself. Those who dispute self-consciousness use a different metaphor. Mind is like a measuring weight. It cannot measure itself at the same time it measures something else. Or, say the Prasangikas, it is like a lamp, but since the very nature of a lamp is illumination, it does not act upon itself to illuminate itself. But how, other than, so self-consciousness is posited by those schools, the Sautrantika being one that we're coming up to, as the way of being able to justify the fact that we can remember we had those experiences. So when we have experienced an object, how is it that we know that we experienced that object, i.e. how do we experience consciousness itself? And so a number of schools, including Sautrantika, posit this what's called self-cognizer, meaning an aspect of the mind while we are experiencing the object. That aspect of the mind simultaneously is experiencing the consciousness itself. And that's how they say we can account for memory and so forth. But other schools say we don't need to talk about this self-consciousness. And what they say is the following. But how, other than self-consciousness, can we account for memory of the subjective aspect of experience? Except for the Prasangikas, other schools account for memory of consciousness itself by the mind's ability to perform introspection, looking inside, which observes a mental state, but a moment after it occurs, as with any other object. So this is what I think was being asked before about metacognition, that the schools that don't accept self-cognizer say that there is this introspective ability, which we have, introspection, but this occurs the moment after we experience something, and that's how we know that we experienced it. Whereas a self-cognizer, the schools that accept self-cognizer, say that this happens simultaneously with experiencing the object. But of course, Prasangikas don't accept either one of those. What do they say? That's the last school we'll be looking at next weekend. It says, Prasangikas deny that self-consciousness is necessary for several other reasons. The most intriguing is that my memories are times when I train my mind to pass upon a past object. This is quite unlike our mechanical model of memory, in which we imagine that memory retrieves stored records of past events and displays them on the screen of consciousness. Rather, we are making contact again with the past object and subject. Shantideva, the 9th century author of the famous Engaging in the Bodhisattva's Deeds, even says that memory can reach the subjective aspect of his experience even if that awareness was not noticed at the time, just by remembering the object. For instance, as long as I can remember Niagara Falls, I can remember me seeing of Niagara Falls through association. So actually, I vaguely remember that in that text, there was this analogy of a bear being bitten by a rat when it was hibernating and remembering that it remembered that as the analogy, but the details I can't remember. So that's a little bit about self-consciousness. But anyway, this Vaibhashika doesn't accept self-consciousness. Okay. We'll talk a little bit more about self-consciousness in the Sautrantika school because they do accept it. So we'll see there the actual details of what it really is in the next school coming up later tomorrow. Okay, so a vaibhashika is someone who doesn't accept that self-cognition, but does accept truly existent external objects, that there is an objective external world there. And here in this text, it divisions, it divides vaibhashikas into three groups. One's vaibhashikas from Kashmir, one's from the western region, and from the central region. So here, it has a very simple way of dividing the vaibhashikas into geographical locations. More commonly here, and we see the footnote here, is that the vaibhashikas are divided into these 18 sub-schools, some of which are simply geographical groups. Some actually have slightly different assertions. And there's a number of different ideas about how these 18 divisions came about originally. And in this tenets text here, it talks about sort of two main ways or ideas about how these 18 divisions came about. And this was on page 145. And remember, these divisions started to form shortly after the time of the Buddha. And here in this, it says that there are sort of two ways in which the 18 schools formed. One is from four sort of main schools, and the other one is from two main schools. And I think the assertion about the two main schools is based on that they had these councils after the time of the Buddha, a number of councils to come together to ratify the Buddhist teachings, to make sure it wasn't being corrupted. And there's one called the Second Council, which happened about 100 years after the Buddha's time. And at that time, there was, I think, a major split in two groups, one called the Stivaras and the other one called the Mahasamgikas. And there was this major split in small differences of understanding of the Buddha's teachings. And within the Mahasamgikas, we have eight of these groups of the 18, and within the Stivaras, 10 of the 18. So that's sort of one of the common ways that of the explanation of these 18 subschools. So again, some of these subschools are merely geographical. Some actually have slightly different assertions. And we'll see in the tenets text here, in certain areas, it will say, oh, by the way, these vaibhashikas say this, these say that. So there are some subtle differences, but as a whole, they have more or less the same assertions. So let's go to the etymology then. So the etymology, it says here, why are they called proponents of particulars? So here, particular is a translation of a Sanskrit word, vibhasa. So that's why vaibhashika literally means proponent of particular, of a particular. So there are two reasons why they are called vaibhashikas or proponents of particulars. It says here, they are called such because they propound tenets through following the Maha Vibhasa. So the Maha Vibhasa was a text written, I think, after the time of the Buddha, and that's in English called the Great Exposition of Particulars. So one assertion is that they're called vaibhashikas because they're following this Maha Vibhasa text as one of their main texts. And the other one is, alternatively, they're called proponents of particulars because they propound the three times to be particulars of substances. So the three times, of course, is past, present, and future. So this is something that none of the other schools assert, that the three times of past, present, and future are substances here means substantially existent. So what does it mean for them to assert past, present, and future to be particulars of substances? So to, again, answer that or try to understand, we'll use this book here. It's on page 208. In the text here, it says, it's in the big text, the big one. Page 208. And this is quoting originally a Tibetan commentary on this tenet. The Tibetan commentary says, the three times are asserted to be particulars or instances of the substantially established things with respect to which they are posited. For example, when divided, a shoot or a sprout has three times which are itself. So what does that mean? So here's a footnote. See if we can understand this. And it's using a pot as the example. Yesterday's pot exists today as a past pot. Clear? So yesterday's pot is so they say that the three times are existing now. So yesterday's pot is existing today as a past pot. Because it's past. Yesterday's pot is past. The past of a thing occurs after its present existence. That is, after its present existence has passed. Tomorrow's pot exists today as a future pot. The future of a thing occurs before its present existence, that is, when its present existence is yet to be. Today's pot exists as a present pot today. In this way, the three times of a pot are instances of a pot. And since the Vaibhashika school, all phenomena are substantially established, the three times of a pot are substantially established. Got that? So this is no other school except assert this. Generally, so there are certainly three times with respect to a particular phenomenon, and that exists simultaneously as substances. Whereas most of the other schools say that past is defined as that which has arisen and has ceased to exist. Present is that which has arisen and not ceased to exist. And future is that which has yet to arise. Whereas Vaibhashika have a different idea about the three times. So it's just a minor point. Yeah, because it says here, the three times are asserted to be particulars, i.e. instances of substantially established things. That's why they're called proponents of particulars, because they say that the three times are particulars or instances of things, and that they're all past, present, future, all substantially established. Substantially existent in general, and this is something that's going to come up, and I think that this is the only school that accepts this, that all phenomena are substantially established. And this comes up a bit more in the Sautrantika. Substantially established versus imputed. And substantially established means something that doesn't need something else to appear for it to appear. Like all the schools, most of the schools at least, say that the person is imputedly existent. Meaning, for the person to appear, we need something else to appear. Body, mind. For a person to appear. Whereas, for example, this flower, for that to appear, we don't need something other than the flower to appear, for the flower to appear to our mind. So that's a substantial existent. Whereas a person is imputed existent. Because for a person to appear, you need something other than the person to appear, i.e. the body, the mind, or part of the body and the mind. Yeah, but that is the flower. All the lower schools, of course, Prasangika would say that everything's imputedly existent, but we're not talking Prasangika now. So for all the lower schools, the parts of the flower is the flower. So that's not something other than the flower. whereas the person is different. But this is an assertion at the lower schools. Again, so we're going from the Svatantrika, the Vaibhashikas are saying everything's substantially existent. At the other spectrum, Prasangika is saying nothing's substantially existent. So we're moving, as we saw earlier, towards that. Because person has two aspects, body and mind, physical and mental. Whereas that is purely physical. And so therefore the parts is the, for the lower schools, is the flower. So we didn't need something other than the flower to appear. So that's why they say that's substantially existent. But again, Prasangika would say, no, no, no. As you said, this is not the flower. This is a piece, a part. So that's why Prasangika say for them, everything's imputedly existed, nothing substantially existed, because for anything to appear, we need something other than that to appear, because that's what the Prasangikas are saying.
What do they say about animals?
Sorry?
What do they say about animals?
Yeah, so when we say person, person is a generic term for sentient being. But also we have within mind substantially existent things according to this. But because person is a combination of those, we come into this imputedly existent realm. Yeah. But I mean, a lot of these things, particularly when we get into Svatantrika, seems common sense, you know? It's not some sort of wacky idea. So that's why if we can really appreciate these schools, then when we talk Prasangika, we'll have a better appreciation of what they're really saying, because we've got something to compare it to.
This view of the three times is really saying, if the moment of time is real, it's real, therefore it'll be real now, and then it's going to be real in the past, and it'll be real in the future. So they're kind of derivatives of that. As soon as you start saying there is reality, a moment of time is something real, you can't say it came into existence or it's not in existence. It's kind of persists.
But I think the Vaibhashikas have a different idea of what three times mean versus the other schools as well. And they also talk about, you know, the sprout existing, the seed existing at the time of the sprout, where no other school would accept that. Okay, then let's go on to number four, the fourth outline, the way of asserting objects. So here we have first definition of thing, that which is able to perform a function. So this is something I think common to all the Buddhist schools, that the definition of thing is that which is able to perform a function. But here, what it means to be able to perform a function, Vaibhashika have a very different idea, is that for all the other schools, for something to be able to perform a function, it has to be impermanent, it has to be changing. Whereas Vaibhashika say no. So therefore we see here in the next line, thing, existent, and object of knowledge are equivalent. Meaning even permanent or unchanging things, according to Vaibhashika, perform a function. Whereas no other school would accept that. So therefore, for all the other schools, existent, there's two types of existent. There are permanent and impermanent. And the impermanent is thing, so functioning thing. Whereas a permanent phenomena would not be considered a functioning thing. Whereas Vaibhashika are unique in accepting or asserting that even permanent things perform a function. because I think they have a little bit different idea what it means to perform a function. So actually we see in the next line there, it says there are two types of things, permanent things and impermanent things. No other Buddhist philosophical system would accept that. Thing and impermanent are mutually inclusive for other schools. Well, no, it means functioning thing because it performs a function. Yeah? Yeah, because even they say like one of the permanent, in fact, let's go to permanent things. So there are some examples of permanent things is uncompounded space, analytical cessations and non-analytical cessations. So uncompounded space here is simply a lack of obstructive contact. That's how it's defined in all the schools. No problem. But they say that performs a function because it performs a function of allowing something to be there. Whereas the other schools would say, well, not really. That's a bit of a sort of stretching it a little bit. So, again, uncompounded space is simply a lack of obstruction. And for Vaibhashikas, that performs a function of allowing something to be there. That's how they sort of twist the idea of being able to perform a function. Analytical cessation and non-analytical cessation, the difference between those two, and these come up quite a lot later, so it's good to have an understanding of what they mean. An analytical cessation is, they're both separations. An analytical cessation is a separation from something to be abandoned, a separation due to an antidote. So we've abandoned something due to an antidote. So particularly analytical cessations come up when we talk a lot about, you know, eliminating ignorance. So we eliminate ignorance in our mind by wisdom, the Vipassana practice. So when we eliminate ignorance from the mind, that elimination or separation from ignorance is called an analytical cessation because we have achieved that separation or that cessation due to the force of an antidote. We've abandoned the cause. Whereas a non-analytical cessation is also a separation, but it's a separation due to a lack of conditions coming together for that thing to arise. So an analytical cessation is we've abandoned the cause, and a non-analytical cessation is simply due to lack of conditions, something can't arise. So that's a non-analytical cessation, the difference. So generally when we go into Vipassana practice, you only will hear about analytical cessations because that's where we are eliminating ignorance and mental afflictions due to the force of an antidote of wisdom. And then here, examples of impermanent things are created phenomena, products, and impermanent phenomena. Any questions about that? Otherwise, yeah. I didn't catch the analytical cessation. Right. So, yeah. So here, when we talk about permanent and impermanent, we have to be careful with these words. Literally in Tibetan, they mean changing and unchanging. So permanent doesn't mean lasting forever, and impermanent doesn't mean not lasting forever. So here, permanent simply means once it's coming into existence, does it change moment by moment? So we can have permanent things that don't last very long, but while they last, they're not changing. And we can have impermanent things that last forever. For example, our mind, the continuum of our mind is changing moment by moment, but it's doesn't it last forever? So we need to understand when we see in these sort of texts the word permanent and impermanent, it's not talking about how long something exists, it's simply talking about the fact, is this thing changing from moment to moment or not? Okay. So let's go over onto the next page. And here we talk about a way of dividing things into what's called the two truths. And particularly next weekend when we go into the Chittamatra and the Majjhimika system, there's a lot of discussion on the two truths. And the way in which the two truths are presented in the Mahayana systems, in the Chittamatra and Majjhimika, is quite different to how the two truths are presented here in these two schools, the Vaibhashika Satrantika. Here, in Vaibhashika Satrantika, two truths are two different types of things. Either something is a conventional truth or an ultimate truth. They're talking about two types of things. In fact, it says another way of dividing things is into two. Whereas in the Chittamatra and the Majjhimika system, it's not a division. It's two aspects of each phenomena. Each phenomena, with respect to each phenomena, we can talk about conventional truth and ultimate truth. So to explain that a little bit more, again, I'll just read a little bit from here, from this book. It's on page 55. The Vaibhashika and Satrantika schools, which we're looking at now, particularly Vaibhashika at the moment, have a markedly different perspective on the two truths from the Mahayana schools. For the Mahayana schools, ultimate truths are the real way that phenomena exist. Depending on which school we look at, i.e. the emptiness of something superimposed by our ignorance, depending on which school we look at, the emptiness is of, and it gives a list of them, I won't go into them now. For Hinayana schools, on the other hand, ultimate truths are certain kinds of things themselves. So in the Mahayana school, ultimate truth is how things exist, whereas in these two schools we're looking at, ultimate truths are certain kinds of things. For Vaibhashikas and Satrantikas following scripture, ultimate truths are the kinds of things for which any part is recognizable as that thing. Actually, rather than reading it, I think it's better here to look at the definition of the two truths here in the Vaibhashika, and then we'll slowly finish for today. So in the Vaibhashika, so conventional truth, ultimate truth are two different types of things. So here, a conventional truth is a phenomena such that an awareness apprehending it is cancelled if it is broken up or mentally separated into its individual parts. So what does that mean? It goes on, it says, illustrations of conventional truths are a vase and a woolen cloth, because if a vase is broken with a hammer, the mind apprehending it is cancelled. And if the woolen cloth is separated into its individual threads, the mind apprehending it is cancelled. So basically, a conventional truth for Vaibhashika is anything that can be broken down into something else, a physical object, even mental object. Whereas an ultimate truth, it says here, is a phenomenon such that an awareness apprehending it is not cancelled if it is broken up or mentally separated into its individual parts. So some illustrations of ultimate truths are directionally partless particles, temporally partless moments of consciousness, and uncomposed phenomenon. Because these cannot be broken down further. So, therefore, for them, ultimate truths are really the building blocks of the universe. That the partless particles are the building blocks of the physical universe, and the temporally partless moments of consciousness are the building blocks of the mental universe. So the ultimate truths are really the foundations of the mind and the physical universe. So this is, and then here's a quote from Abhidharma Kosha, the text from Vasubandhu, that the Sautrantikas following scripture follow. So they, as we're going to see when we start the Sautrantika, the first subschool within Sautrantika also accept this idea of the two truths, is that the quote is, those things such as a pot or water which the mind cannot engage if they are broken or mentally separated into other things exist as conventional truth, others exist as ultimate truth. And here we have the idea of the three times. It says, the three times are accepted to be substances. A pot is accepted to exist also at the time of the past of the pot and at the time of the future of the pot. So we looked at the three times being substances previously. So just going back to the two truths again. So here then, Vaibhashika and the first part of the Sautrantika school accept that conventional truth is anything that can be broken down in such a way that the mind that's apprehending it can no longer apprehend it. Because if we break down this vase here into bits, then there's just bits there. There's no vase that we can apprehend anymore. Whereas when we break that down into the smallest components, the temporally directionally partless particles and temporary partless moments of consciousness for mental events, these are considered to be then ultimate truth. So any questions about two truths before we finish today?
Just a question on why is it a kind of time and an ultimate truth?
Sorry? Why is it an ultimate? Is it
not? Why is it not an ultimate truth? Because by this definition, it's a conventional truth. And yet, I would thought the definition of an ultimate truth is it's not harmless.
Present moment of time. Present moment of time. Yeah, but remember, we're talking here about consciousness. So you're talking about present moment of time. See, I think, again, the way the Vaibhashika is not defining past, present, future in this way. You know, in the other schools, we're talking about past is that which has arisen and ceased to exist. Present is that which has arisen and not ceased to exist, and future is that which is yet to arisen. Whereas here, the three times are substances of, with respect to a phenomena. So they only respect to a phenomena. So we can talk about present pot, past pot, future pot. But if we break the pot down, there's no present, past or future anymore. Because they're with respect to us and a phenomena. Yeah, so I think our normal way of talking about past, present, future in Vaibhashika is they have a different idea about it. I must admit the Vaibhashika idea of past, present, future is a little bit mystifying. Huh? Yeah. Yeah, this is a different school.
No. It seems like it's opposite, because when I look at this one, like the hardest part of it, at least, I mean, apparently in total space is kind of a phenomenon.
Yeah, but remember, they can all perform a function. For Vaibhashika, everything, if it's an existent, it performs a function. So also, all of these ultimate truths perform a function for Vaibhashika. Yeah, so uncomposed or uncompounded, again, is something that is not produced by causes and conditions. So So uncomposed means it's not composed or produced through causes and conditions. Actually, in the Sautrantika system we're going to start to look at later tomorrow, there are a number of different synonyms for these things which I'll go into. But I think composed or compounded phenomena is anything produced through causes and conditions. So an uncomposed or uncompounded phenomena is something not produced through causes and conditions. In other words, something that's not changing moment by moment. Yeah, I mean, here, of course, and this is accepted by the other schools as well, that we can talk about uncompounded space. So we have to be careful when we see this word space, you know. And space is used a lot in a number of these schools, but it's not talking about this space that we can see with our eyes. That's compounded space. That's an object of visual consciousness. Uncompounded space is simply a lack of obstructive contact. So it's an absence, it's a lack. And so anything that is an absence or a lack, we can't perceive with the sense consciousnesses because it's just a lack. It's a permanent phenomenon. So whenever we see space in text, usually it means uncompounded space. It means this lack or absence of obstructive contact. And this comes up a lot in the Prasangika, in the Majjhimika philosophical system, where they talk about emptiness. Because emptiness is also an absence or a lack. It's a lack or an absence of inherent existence. So as an analogy for emptiness, they often talk about uncompounded space. In terms, they're both the same as they're both simply an absence or a lack. What we'll see actually in the Sautrantika system starting tomorrow, this idea of non-affirming negative that's coming up. It's the same idea. It's just a mere negation. It's a mere lack. So that's why often Prasangika, when we talk about emptiness meditation, we often talk about space-like emptiness practice. So they're similar in they're both a mere negation, a lack, a simple absence of something. Of course, the absence of what they're absent of is very different, of course. Yeah, I think so, yeah. But of course, in Vaibhashika, even permanent phenomena are things. They function, whereas no other school would accept that. So that completes the fourth part of Vaibhashika, the assertion of objects. And then we're going to start tomorrow morning with the fifth outline, the way of asserting object possessors. As we see here, we're going to go into what's talk about valid cognition and perception and inference and so forth. So let's leave it there today. Before we run away, maybe we can just sit quietly for a moment and dedicate, based on our motivation that we developed this morning, just in our own way, dedicate the positive potential that we've gathered here today through our discussions and meditations. Thank you for coming today. Have a nice evening. We'll see you tomorrow morning at 10 o'clock.